Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It is Monday, June 29th, 2026, and you are joining us for our Startups Edition.
Today, we are examining the fundamental shift from passive LLMs to autonomous agentic experiences. We are moving away from tools that merely respond to prompts toward systems that proactively execute complex workflows within our digital ecosystems.
It is no longer about what the model says, but what the agent actually does.
Precisely.
We begin by exploring the new frontiers of the AI landscape, specifically the transition from basic language modeling to true agentic experience. In January, GPT-5 and Gemini managed to resolve about a dozen open mathematical problems that had been sitting unsolved for years. It turns out the frontier isn't just a metaphor anymore, it's a measurable leap in raw logic. Today is June 29th, 2026, and we are looking at the AI frontier, from LLMs to agentic experience.
We are moving from a period of mere text generation into an era of autonomous agents and scientific reasoning. The shift is being driven by a move toward reasoning traces, where models no longer just predict the next word, but engage in an internal monologue to self-correct their logic before they ever output a response to the user.
So we've moved from chatbots that hallucinate beautifully to chatbots that actually think about why they might be lying to us. That is a terrifyingly specific kind of progress.
It's actually a structural shift in architecture. Mark Andreessen has noted that the breakthrough in reasoning 18 months ago, specifically the ability to process these internal reasoning traces, is what moved the needle from creative hallucination to solving complex logic puzzles. It's the difference between a poet and a mathematician.
And for the startups watching this, that math is starting to look a lot like a takeover.
So here's the picture. There is a growing defensibility crisis for early-stage vertical AI companies. If you built a startup that just provides specialized legal summaries, you're in trouble because foundational providers like Anthropic are now integrating specialized legal agents directly into their core platforms. The moat is evaporating because the models are eating the verticals.
It's the classic platform risk, but instead of a platform just adding a feature, the platform is becoming the entire industry.
The data tells a story. Reid Hoffman has expressed skepticism regarding the long-term viability of these vertical AI startups. He argues that the industry is shifting focus away from LLMs and toward physical AI and world models, systems that use proprietary data from physical environments to understand how the real world actually functions, something a text-only model can't replicate.
So if you can't win on the digital layer, you have to go win on the atoms layer.
That is the new frontier for high-growth investment. We are seeing the emergence of a multi-layered reinforcement learning loop. As Kevin Weil describes it, the goal is to integrate in silico simulations with horizontally scalable robotic labs. This allows models to run experiments in a digital simulation and then direct physical robots to conduct the real-world validation, automating the scientific process without human fatigue.
I love the idea of a robot lab that never sleeps, but I'm a little concerned about the intelligence in that loop. If we give these agents the keys to the lab, are we delegating tasks or are we just surrendering?
That's the fundamental tension between cognitive delegation and cognitive surrender. In the current design landscape, we are seeing a transition from user experience, or UX, to agentic experience, or AX. As the A16Z show argues, the designer's focus is shifting from visual interfaces meant for humans to designing non-visual functional affordances, like specialized API instructions or robots, TXD, specifically for AI agents to consume.
So instead of making a button pretty for me to click, a designer's job is now to make sure a bot doesn't trip over the digital architecture. It's less UI design and more instruction manual for a ghost.
It's more programmatic than that. The future of software might not even be a website or an app you visit. We are looking at the rise of the OpenAI apps platform, where business models exist entirely within agentic interfaces. You don't go to a travel site to book a flight, you interact with an agent that negotiates the booking for you.
Which sounds wonderful until you realize you've lost all oversight. You're just a passenger in a transaction you didn't even see happen.
But that's where the new personal intelligence comes in. Josh Ellman suggests the next wave isn't just about job replacement, but about agents that leverage your private context, your emails, your calendars, your preferences to act as high-level intermediaries. They can negotiate logistics or even diffuse emotional tension in professional debates by focusing discussions on objective data.
It's like having a tiny, incredibly efficient, and slightly sociopathic personal assistant.
The real strategic opportunity there is what is being called generative engine optimization, or GEO. Since agents are acting as the new intermediaries, the goal for a startup is no longer just SEO to rank in a search engine, but ensuring that AI agents are incentivized to refer users to your specific service or artifact during their problem-solving process.
Wait, so I'm not trying to rank one on Google. I'm trying to bribe a bot to mention my brand in its summary of the internet.
It's about being the preferred tool in the agent's toolbox. However, there is a massive economic hurdle. The A16Z show points out that the transition from cloud computing to AI-driven inference is actually reversing the traditional startup advantage of low-cost distribution. In the cloud era, it was cheap to scale. In the AI era, the high cost of inference requires either a massive balance sheet or a user base with a very high willingness to be charged.
The move fast and break things era is being replaced by the move fast and hope you can afford your server bill era.
And that brings us to the infrastructure. There is a massive debate about the sustainability of this. As noted in Masters of Scale, the projected $8 to $12 trillion in capital expenditure for data centers would require an almost unrealistic $4 trillion in new revenue just to justify the investment. We are betting on a massive expansion of human wants that hasn't fully materialized in the revenue numbers yet.
It's a lot of bets on a future that we are currently simulating in a lab.
But the potential upside is the science of 2050 happening in 2030. If these models can accelerate breakthroughs in materials science and superconductivity, the economic payoff isn't just incremental. It's a total rebaselining of what is possible.
Even if we can't agree on whether the models are helping us or replacing us, the developers of these agentic interfaces need to start prioritizing the handoff. The most successful AI-native products won't try to do everything in one chat box. They will be the ones that know exactly when to hand the user off to a specialized, immersive application.
The complexity is moving from the interface to the orchestration.
Investors should look for startups building the orchestrator layer or the specialized handoff protocols rather than the end-user chat window. Watch for the first time a major consumer agent autonomously executes a high-value, multi-step financial transaction without a human confirm click. That will tell us if we've entered the era of true autonomy or just high-speed automation. But as we automate the logic of the world, we have to wonder if we're losing the very things that make human innovation worth pursuing, especially when it comes to the way we design our own lives and health. Alex, if you could design a perfectly optimized human experience, would you start by fixing our biology or just by deleting the parts of our brains that make us crave a midnight bag of chips?
I think you're describing the fundamental pivot happening in the startup ecosystem right now, moving away from just building tools and toward human-centric innovation, where the goal is to engineer specific physiological and psychological states.
It sounds less like innovation and more like we're trying to hack our way out of being human. Are we just trying to build a better version of ourselves, or are we just building better ways to be distracted?
It's actually much more structural than that. We're seeing a convergence of pharmacotherapy, wearable tech, and AI that is essentially redesigning the interface of our daily lives. Take the explosion of GLP-1 medications. For a long time, the industry viewed them as just another weight loss drug, but as Noom CEO Jeff Cook has argued, they are actually a catalytic window.
A catalytic window. That sounds like something a realtor says right before they show you a house with a collapsing foundation.
In this case, the foundation is your brain chemistry. The mechanism is that by reducing food noise, that constant intrusive craving for high-calorie foods, the drugs create a period of increased self-efficacy. If you use that window to implement habit stacking, like layering protein intake or exercise onto an existing routine, you can establish automated microhabits that persist even after the medication is discontinued.
So the drug isn't the solution. It's just the heavy lifting crew that clears the debris so you can actually build the road.
And that's creating a massive downstream opportunity for startups. If the drug handles the hunger, the real value moves to the protein delivery systems and the behavioral infrastructure. Look at David, the protein bar company. Their CEO, Peter Rahal, is essentially betting on the clinical necessity of high protein intake to prevent muscle atrophy in GLP-1 users. They aren't just making snacks, they are leveraging biohacking technologies like modified triglycerides or EPG to decouple mouthfeel from calories.
Wait, so we're basically engineering food to trick our mouths into thinking we're eating something delicious, while our cells are actually just receiving a highly optimized nutrient payload. That feels like trying to trick a toddler into eating broccoli by painting it to look like a chocolate chip.
It's more sophisticated than that. Unlike the 1990s fat replacement technologies like Olestra, which failed because they were thermally unstable and caused major digestive distress, modern EPG is a hard fat with a high melting point. It stays solid in the body, so you get the texture without the biological fallout.
Okay, so the biology is being upgraded. But what about the experience part? Are we just becoming more efficient biological machines?
That's where the design element comes in. There's this idea, often discussed in the context of experience design, that the relationship between experience quality and behavior is a J-curve rather than a linear one. As noted in FOMO Sapiens with Patrick J. McGinnis, moving an experience from bad to average doesn't actually drive predictable behavior change. You have to hit level 5 experiences, what some call love, to move the needle.
Love in a business context. That sounds like the kind of thing a CEO says right before they announce a mandatory fun retreat in the middle of a quarterly slump.
It's actually a measurable metric. In a professional or consumer context, love is defined as any experience that allows a person to reduce their armor plating, to stop being defensive or hypervigilant and start flourishing. For a startup, the goal isn't just to make a product that is not annoying, but to design touchpoints that facilitate control, harmony, significance, warmth, and growth.
Instead of just making an app that works, you're trying to make an app that makes me feel significant. That feels like a lot of emotional heavy lifting for a software update.
But that's the competitive mode. If you use AI just to increase the speed of a transaction, you're just creating a more efficient way to frustrate people. If the AI lacks empathy, you're just building a high-speed friction machine. The real opportunity lies in using AI as a design partner, an optimization engine that uses massive multimodal datasets from your blood chemistry to your sleep patterns to proactively create these positive emotional states.
It's like we're moving from software as a service to self as a service, where the software is constantly tweaking your dopamine levels so you don't notice the subscription fee.
It's less about surveillance and more about reducing the cognitive load. The most successful consumer products of the next decade might follow a high-retention, low-awareness strategy, as suggested in the A16Z show. The goal isn't mass-market fame, it's securing a deeply committed user base whose very habits have been fundamentally altered by the product. You aren't chasing users, you are embedding yourself into their biological and psychological architecture.
It's a bold play. You're not just selling a product, you're selling a new way to exist. But it's also a massive responsibility. If you're designing the experience of someone's life, you're essentially acting as a digital architect for their personality.
And that requires a move away from the efficiency-driven models of the past. In healthcare, for example, the handoff model, where a patient is passed from one specialist to another, is inherently unloving because it forces the patient to be the sole narrator of their own trauma. The future belongs to the hospitalist model, where a dedicated role manages the transitions and reduces the emotional burden. Startups that can automate that care through AI while maintaining a curated aura or personality will be the ones that actually achieve that level 5 status.
I suppose the real test is whether we actually get to flourish or if we just become really efficient at being incredibly well-managed.
The differentiator will be whether the technology is used for coercion or for true expansion.
Investors should look for founders who are building habit-anchored ecosystems rather than standalone utilities.
Watch for the first major experience-driven AI agent that can successfully navigate a high-friction human crisis without defaulting to a generic recovery mode script.
But all of that deep, personal optimization is only useful if you can actually scale the infrastructure required to support it. Apparently, if you want to scale a music school, you don't just hire better guitarists, you implement a proprietary app to essentially police their repertoire and prevent them from being sued by music publishers.
It's less about policing and more about de-risking the unit economics, Maya. We're looking at the mechanics of scaling the machine, moving from a startup that relies on heroic individual teachers to a system-driven institution.
Right, because nothing says rock and roll like a centralized database of 1,000 copyright-cleared songs and a standardized digital curriculum. It's a move that's going to lead to fewer lawsuits, fewer spontaneous jams, and eventually, a very efficient, very boring corporate retreat in a windowless conference room.
But that friction is exactly what defines the scaling phase. Take the School of Rock case study. They faced a massive legal threat from the publisher Hal Leonard. To survive, they had to move from a control-based model, where HQ tells teachers exactly what to do via mandates and penalties, to a results-based model. They used data to show teachers that using the Method app actually doubled student retention.
Instead of do this or you're fired, it's do this or you're losing half your revenue. A much more polite way to strip away professional autonomy.
It's what we call structured empowerment. The goal is to provide a curated library of best practices so the soul of the brand remains, but the legal and operational risks are mitigated. It's the transition from a founder-led product to a process-driven machine.
Which sounds like a nightmare for any founder who actually likes their original vision.
It is, especially around the 20-employee mark. Jack Altman has argued that a CEO's fundamental role must shift from building the product to building the machine that builds the product. If you don't make that pivot, you hit a ceiling. You have to move up the hierarchy of needs. First, ensure solvency, then achieve product market fit, then build the team, and finally develop the processes.
And I assume if you skip a step, the whole thing just evaporates.
Something to flag here, you can't build a sophisticated process for a product nobody wants. But even when you have the product, you face the superstar paradox. High-performing individuals provide the initial brand equity, but true scalability requires transitioning from a hero-based model to system-based model. You're trading individual brilliance for consistent, predictable output.
It's the death of the artisan.
It's the birth of the institution. Look at Disney. Their foundation wasn't just a creative spark. It was a specific 1923 contract for 12 Alice comedies that provided the necessary capital to establish commercial viability. They then moved from random licensing to professionalized agency management, which allowed merchandise revenue to eclipse film rentals by 1934. They built a massive, vertically integrated library of IP that creates a cornered resource no competitor can replicate in a standard 5 to 10 year window.
So the strategy is, find a hit, lock down the rights, and then build a fortress of paperwork around it.
We can trace that further in modern tech, that fortress is often built with code. The A16Z show noted that high-scale organizations can achieve massive engineering velocity by transitioning from reactive Java to more declarative code as hardness architecture. They literally reduced the engineering resource requirement for marketplace launches from 60 engineers over 9 months to just 2 engineers over 2 months. They are commoditizing the non-core functions to focus exclusively on high-equity value algorithms.
It sounds like the ultimate goal is to automate the human part of the business until there's nothing left but a very efficient, very profitable algorithm.
The goal is to prevent cultural whiplash. When you implement standardization, the veterans see it as a power grab. The trick is co-creation, inviting those expert practitioners to contribute to the central system. If they help build the tool, they don't see it as an imposition, they see it as an enhancement. You have to use ice core sampling, constantly auditing the micro-level of the organization, to ensure that as you scale, the quality hasn't drifted away from the original mission.
Investors looking at your growth metrics should start checking the ice cores rather than just the top-line revenue.
Worth noting, if the growth is coming from a hero who might leave tomorrow, you don't have a machine. You have a precarious dependency.
Founders need to stop obsessing over the next big feature and start obsessing over the plumbing.
The real test is whether your latest operational update increases your retention or just increases your headcount.
But as these systems become more global and integrated, the friction is moving from the office to the border.
We'll be looking at how shifting trade alliances and new physical barriers are rewriting the rules of how goods actually move around the world.
I was trying to order a new laptop yesterday, and the delivery date was sometime in 2028. It turns out the entire planet is hitting a wall. We aren't just talking about a little shipping delay. We're talking about a massive, fundamental bottleneck in the global supply chain that is essentially choking the life out of the AI revolution.
It's much deeper than just shipping containers, Maya. We're seeing a collision between digital ambition and physical reality. There is a massive backlog in the AI stack, ranging from a 4-year lead time on power transformers to critical shortages in cooling systems and even the rare earth materials needed for hardware.
Scaling the AI revolution is actually just code for waiting 4 years for a very large, very expensive electrical transformer to arrive.
Stepping back, this physical scarcity is driving a literal downgrade in intelligence for the end user. Because developers can't get enough GPUs or enough energy to power massive clusters, they are being forced to deploy less capable, smaller models to businesses and consumers right now.
That is a depressing way to spend a Monday. But it's not just about the hardware, is it? There's this massive geopolitical chess game happening in the background.
It is.
The A16Z show noted that we're seeing a profound strategic paradox in the US-China competition. On one hand, the US wants to restrict high-end chip exports to maintain a security advantage. But on the other hand, the technological imperative suggests that if we don't aggressively export American AI software and hardware to set the global standard, we effectively hand the keys to our competitors.
So we either export it and risk leakage, or we restrict it and let them build their own version.
It's a telling detail. And as the A16Z show also warned, China might be playing a turbo-dumping strategy. They could be flooding the global market with high-quality, open-source AI models specifically to undermine the profitability of American firms, making it impossible for US companies to establish a sustainable, proprietary business model.
They use openness as a weapon to crash the market price of intelligence. It's brilliant and terrifying.
It's a massive risk for the startup ecosystem. We're also seeing a shift in where the actual value is being built. There's a new generation of American companies emerging that are moving away from the old model of relying on Chinese contract manufacturing. Instead, they're building their entire corporate DNA around domestic production, specifically to leverage the synergy between national security and operational excellence. You see clusters of this defense tech manufacturing popping up in places like El Segundo and Hawthorne.
It sounds like the free market is being replaced by a fortress market.
It's more complex than that. The Tim Ferriss show highlighted that the real danger isn't just the trade war, but the domestic fallout. If we hit this era of AI superabundance, but the transition causes concentrated labor displacement, much like the China shock of the early 2000s, the political backlash could be massive. Even a disruption of a few million jobs can trigger a swing toward extreme protectionism.
Founders need to watch their hardware procurement timelines as much as their burn rate.
Keep an eye on the 2028 window for that projected vertical progress spike in model development.
If that spike happens while the power grid is still stuck in 2024, the whole thing might just short-circuit. But speaking of things that are changing right under our noses, let's talk about how the way we build audiences is moving away from massive platforms and toward individual personality.
I've been obsessing over this fundamental shift in how startups actually build value. We are moving from the era of the abstract corporate brand to the era of the name on the door.
That sounds like a very expensive way of saying the founder is now the marketing department.
It's deeper than that. The A16Z show noted that 20th century giants like GE or GM had to distill their identities into neutral, atomic units just to fit through the narrow straw of limited TV and print space. But now, with unlimited long-form channels, the mechanism has flipped. You don't need a polished plastic corporate persona. You need a person who can utilize unscripted deep-dive platforms to build a direct connection with an audience.
Instead of a carefully curated press release, we're just getting a 3-hour podcast of a CEO arguing with people on X.
Two things stand out. And in this landscape, being uninteresting is a fatal flaw. The strategy is no longer about pitching the company as the subject. It's about plugging your company into massive, existing global narratives like AI or geopolitics. If you can make your company's relevance an implicit byproduct of a larger story, you bypass the need for traditional advertising.
It sounds like a lot of pressure on the individual. If the brand is the person, what happens when the person has a bad day or says something wildly controversial?
You lean into the friction. Alex Karp suggested that while leaders should avoid low-impact critics, they should actually embrace significant friction to showcase their point of view. It's about building reps of interpersonal exposure. Success is driven by high-frequency encounters with diverse, high-stakes personas, everything from Hollywood to Silicon Valley, which develops a specialized founder taste for vetting deals.
It's less about the product roadmap and more about looks maxing for cultural perception.
The implication runs deeper. The A16Z show suggests future competitive advantage will be found by those who can either dominate technical compute or master the ability to control human mindshare. It's moving from transactional models like selling merch toward high-margin institutional ownership.
Seed investors need to start vetting a founder's podcast engagement metrics as closely as their burn rate. Watch for the first major enterprise software unicorn to launch an IPO without a single traditional media interview. As we wrap up this Monday, June 29th, the thread pulling through today's discussion is the collapse of the distinction between digital intelligence and biological habit. We are moving past the era of using tools to solve problems and entering an era where technology is being woven into our very physiology, whether that's through agentic workflows that manage our logic or bio-optimization that manages our dopamine.
The pattern is clear for the founders and VCs listening. The single most critical implication is this: the fundamental unit of value is shifting from the proprietary algorithm to the integrated interface. If you're building a specialized software layer, your margin is being liquidated by the platform plays like OpenAI's new app ecosystem. The real opportunity now lies in SaaS to self as a service, building the infrastructure that manages the friction between massive autonomous compute and the messy reality of human biology and physical logistics. The winners won't just be those with the smartest models, but those who successfully bridge the gap between high-level reasoning and the atoms layer of the real world.
It's a high-stakes pivot from managing data to managing autonomy.
To see if this thesis holds, keep a close eye on the first major enterprise-scale rollout of an autonomous agentic platform in the coming months. We aren't looking for a flashy marketing campaign or a keynote. We are looking for the first high-value multi-step financial transaction or supply chain reconfiguration that executes successfully without a single human handoff or approval step. That moment will signal that the transition from reactive software to proactive agency is no longer a projection, but a functional reality.
That's the signal we're hunting for. Thanks for joining us this week.
We'll see you next Monday.